Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Tripp Friedler, whose new book is The Tunnel, a memoir. And Tom Loewenberg of Octavia Books has some end-of-summer reading recommendations. The name Tripp Friedler, you probably think of him as a businessman or the CEO of a multifamily office, especially if you've only read his first book, Free Gulliver, Six Swift Lessons in Life Planning. But in his new book, you'll see a different side of him, a dedicated family man, a concerned father, finally a grieving parent after the death of his son, Henry. In this gut-wrenching memoir, Tripp talks about the toll bipolar disorder took on his family. It's called The Tunnel, a memoir. Tripp, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. Thanks for having me.
So what made you ready to write this book? Why was now the time?
I don't think there's ever really a good time. You know, it's interesting with books. I started this book as something else. There's a great little story between Kurt Vonnegut and Joe Heller. It's actually called a poem by Kurt Vonnegut called Joe Heller. But I'm paraphrasing a little bit. Basically, it goes, Joe and Kurt are at a party on Fire Island at a billionaire's house. And Kirk goes to Joe, he goes, Joe, do you realize this guy probably made more yesterday than you made your entire career in Catch-22? And Joe goes, well, Kurt, that's true, but I got something he doesn't have. Kirk goes, Joe, what do you possibly have that he doesn't have? And Joe Heller goes, I have enough. And that fascinated me. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to somehow make sense of Henry's death and interweave it with the notion of enough.
What is enough?
Right. So that's the way the book started. And then anyone who's ever written a book understands that it takes a life of its own. And as I was writing, I realized this story was a story in and of itself, mm-hmm. and it didn't need any business in it. It needed to be told from the perspective of a family who's been on a crazy journey and the lessons learned.
And happy lessons recently, as you became a new grandfather recently.
I became a grandfather on August 11th, 2024. Charlotte Henry George, beautiful little girl. And we are ecstatic, which, you know, sort of how I end the book is with Patty's wedding. What you learn in life, no one gets through life unscathed. Yeah. Nobody. You know, some crosses are harder to bear than others, but everyone has something they have to face. And what you learn is that you do the best you can and you keep moving on and you find your happiness where you can find it. And if you look, you'll find it.
Right. Now, you open this book with such a harrowing scene. It's the kind of phone call no parent ever wants to get. And you're captured by it immediately. So talk a little bit about that moment.
Yeah, that was a crazy moment. It's interesting, in the back of the book, under author's note, I say that history is a weird thing and we all remember history in different ways. And in writing this book, I remembered that pretty vividly. And when I read it to Heidi, my wife, she goes, well, wait, I was with you when that call came. And so that's in the book correctly. Mm-hmm. What I will never forget is that just feeling of dread when he tells me, crying, that he's on the Mississippi River Bridge, and that feeling of talking him home.
Yeah.
I put this in the book, but it's ironic that he was driving up Chapultepec, up the very river he could have been floating down.
Right.
And just so many things went right to have that not happen. Who knows what would happen if a policeman had stopped or a motorist had stopped, because he was out of the car looking over the edge. It was certainly a wake-up call. He had not had a manic moment at that point, but it was clearly a vivid wake-up call as to depression and what depression can do.
Well, the thing about a memoir is a lot of people think, well, you just sit down and write and you remember, but you don't. You have to go back and research your own life. You have to reconstruct it, reevaluate it, and put it in order in a way. So talk about that process, because Heidi was a big part of that.
Yes,
with you too.
Reluctantly. our marriage survived that, barely. Heidi has not read this book.
Wow.
She doesn't want to read the book. As she says, she lived the book. She doesn't need to read it. Mm-hmm. We all process pain in different ways.
Right.
And one of the reasons that I think Heidi and I's marriage is as strong as it is we realize that we process pain in different ways. So this was important to me, not so much her. However, Heidi was the keeper of the records. And so You're 100% right. Piecing all this stuff together was hard. And so luckily, Heidi had kept notes, because as Henry progressed and went to different places to try to get better, she had made notes of when certain things had happened. That was extremely helpful. And that gave me the raw outline I needed. The interesting thing in writing a memoir, it's a little bit like making a movie. So where you put things is also interesting. So to be fair, the bridge scene was not always the opening scene.
Well, sure.
And so I just felt like that was as good a way as any to introduce the reader to the story. It was a process, and I learned a lot as I wrote this book, stuff I'd forgotten and stuff that I wish I could have forgotten.
Just talk about being Henry's father. You had such a crooked path to finding help. And you are a person, as you readily acknowledge, with resources.
Yes.
Not everybody has those resources. Not everybody gets the kind of help they need.
Yes.
So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. There's a saying that I have in the Friedler family, which is, if you have the money for the solution, you don't have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And you might not want to spend it, but then that's on you.
Yeah, right.
Right? If you have the money, you don't have the problem. And mental health is one of those ones where that's not true. You know, no money's going to solve that problem.
Mm-hmm.
What it allowed us to do was to get the best help that we could find. In the end, it didn't work. But it's heart-wrenching for me to think about the fact that people go through this with no resources. You know, my heart goes out to them, which is one of the reasons I'm becoming a big donor to mental health causes, to try to give everyone the ability to get the help they need.
Well, talk about some of the things you tried.
Oh, gosh. So before his first manic episode, we sent Henry to Costa Rica to try to something called Pure Life, which is a great program which works on instilling in kids, young adolescents, values and self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
As my brother likes to say, one of the ways to get self-esteem is do self-esteeming things. And so, you know, we sent Henry to Costa Rica. That did not go well at all. You know, there were so many things. We sent him to a place in North Carolina. Again, did not go well. Mental health is a little like addiction. Well, I mean, they're all phases of mental illness, where if the person going through it does not want the help, there's very little that anyone else can do. There really is very little that anyone else can do. And so for the longest time, Henry just didn't want the help. And bipolar is a particularly horrible disease because he didn't think he was sick. We were the ones who were sick. Who wants help if they don't think they got a problem?
And also, Henry wasn't your only child.
No, he was not my only child. So though at times it felt like it, and I'm sure the girls, I have an older daughter and a younger daughter, and I'm certain they felt that we were spending inordinate amount of time, energy, and resources on their brother. And so it had to have been hard on them. It was especially hard on Kate, my youngest. We called the energy twins.
Right.
They were 15 months apart. You know, she as well has not read the book. I'm sort of like a little island out there in my inner family. My in-laws have read the book. My stepmom read the book. But my immediate family, it's still a little painful. They can't really read it.
I understand that.
Yeah, I understand it too. I mean, I totally understand it, and they understand it.
I would say that you honor their feelings. You particularly honor Heidi's grief.
Yeah.
You know, I think you write about that with great compassion.
Yeah, well, I mean...
And I'm sure that was very difficult.
Right. And she, you know, is the love of my life. So, you know, without Heidi, I don't know what I would do.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's that Jerry Maguire, You Complete Me. she really completes me because she's... All of my weak spots are her strengths.
Well, that's a lucky thing.
That is a lucky thing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tripp Friedler, whose new book is The Tunnel, a memoir. So what did this do for you? How long did it take?
So it took about a year. I started writing in August of 2022. It takes a while. I attacked it with gusto. I don't even want to go back and read the first draft. A lot changed. But I just started, I don't know about other writers, but for me, I like to just spit out words. You know, I just start writing and writing and writing and writing, and I'm not really worried.
I just keep writing
and trying to get it out and then go back to find the diamonds in a whole sea of crap. And so it took a long time. And then even when I'd finished, I had an editor who worked with it and polished it up a little bit. And then luckily for me, there was a writer's strike in Hollywood, and one of my closest friend, Stephen Gottschall, who's a great TV writer, was on strike.
Uh-huh.
And he came to visit me in Florida, and he literally went through every page, every word. I mean, we went through and workshopped it till it was right. And then my last editor, Kristen Sanders, who got I think either LSU or UNO, her master's in creative writing, she was in Paris, and she was my last editor. But, you know, I've gotten a lot of great feedback on this book, and I tell, and especially from friends who have read it, and the feedback is, wow, this is good. And I said, well, I benefit from two things, low expectations and great editing. But don't ever underestimate a great editor.
Never. Everyone needs an editor.
Everyone needs a great editor. And I listened to most of what they said. Some I felt strongly about, I wanted to keep. But the process of writing was so cathartic to me, and just it felt so good that I just kept writing, and it took about a year.
And you know that you're doing something good for it. You know that the money that comes from this book will support things that are important to you. So talk a little bit about those efforts.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The feedback I've gotten from most people is, wow, that's so brave of you. Thank you for doing it. This will be so helpful to so many people. And I hope it is, but it was extremely helpful to me.
Mm-hmm.
I feel selfish in a way because it's just, and I get a little emotional about this, but it's just, I had a therapist tell me that when we have children, we raise our kids, and all we really want to do is put them out in the world and hope they do well, right? And so this is my way of being able to put Henry out in the world and hope that he is well received, because he really is a hero to me. I mean, what he went through is hard. And it's interesting, in trying to promote this book, I could give all the copies away and I'm going to make as much money as if they sell. I just hope that it resonates and that it becomes a book people can turn to help them get through what they're going through, because mostly I hope that it can raise a whole bunch of money for a cause that is really undervalued by society.
Tell the story behind the title, if you would. I think that's something that would mean a lot to people who live in New Orleans and travel your routes.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because I ask people if they know that tradition. So there's a tradition that I grew up with, that when you go through a tunnel and you can hold your breath through the tunnel, you get to make a wish.
Right.
Right. Not everyone knows that tradition, unbelievably, but everyone I know who grew up in New Orleans knows that tradition. And certainly everyone I know who ever went from New Orleans to the Florida coast knows that tradition, because the Mobile Tunnel is the perfect tunnel for that.
It's just right.
It's just right, because as I say in the book, there's some tunnels that are like so short you feel you don't deserve a wish. Mm-hmm. And then there's some tunnels that are so long you just, I mean, unless you're an underwater diver, you just can't hold your breath that long. But the Mobile Tunnel is perfect because without much traffic, right? A little bit of traffic, you can get through a lot of traffic and you're in trouble. But if you see a lot of red lights in front of you, you're in trouble. But
yep.
You can mostly get through it. And so every time we went through the Mobile Tunnel, which was a lot because we have a place in Florida, I would hold my breath and wish that Henry would get better. And so it just became a great metaphor of my experience.
And a great title for your book.
And a great title for the book.
We've been talking with Tripp Friedler. His new book is The Tunnel, a memoir. You can meet him Wednesday, September 18th at 6 at Octavia Books with Calm Nola. Tuesday, September 24th at Garden District Bookshop with Nick Richard from NAMI, the National Alliance for Mental Illness. And Saturday, September 28th at noon at Barnes & Noble Metairie with the Jewish Family Services Suicide Prevention Team. Tripp, thanks so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Closing in on the end of the summer reading series, and we thought we'd check in with Octavia Books and Tom Loewenberg to see what they're recommending for this last bit of summer reading. Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Hey, Susan. I'm doing great. I'm so excited to be talking to you.
Has it been a busy summer, I hope?
Oh, we stay busy all the time. That's the great thing about bookstores. You know, when people are leaving town, they're getting books. When they're visiting town, they're getting books. And there's summer reading and so many good things that are always coming out each season.
And you've gone through some great changes at the store as well.
Well, we just doubled our size. So we now occupy most of the downstairs of our building and renovated the whole building. And then the restaurant, Scrambled, is right next door. And we have shelves that swing open. You can walk right into the restaurant when they're open from the bookstore or vice versa. So it's exciting. People are turning out to see what's going on and to see the new space and all the books we have.
All right. Well, tell us what you've been reading. Tell us what you'd recommend.
You know, I love reading things that relate locally. And so I just picked up Pierce Oysters by Jocelyn Takacs.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure if I'm pronouncing her name right, but anyway, it's T-A-K-A-C-S. It's set during the time of the BP oil disaster in Louisiana. Some of it's set in New Orleans, but mostly it's set outside of New Orleans in a fictitious place close to the Gulf and following a family that is involved in the oyster industry and kind of telling it in real time as it's unfolding.
It's so interesting to read about oystering. I'm surprised we don't have more books about it.
There have been a few, but not too many. We've had some books just about, I mean, there's oystering, and of course there are books about oysters. Those are sort of different things. But we've had some of both. You might remember John Vigenay did a book a long time ago about oystering in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. There hasn't been anything else lately that I can think of. So this is interesting. And I'm finding that the author really seems to have gotten down a lot of the details about the oil spill more than I, you know, expected. It's interesting as it's unfolding.
And all of us here remember that as if it were yesterday. It's so shocking.
Yeah, we might like not to remember it, but it is important to remember, like so many other things. That we
exactly.
Like.
So what else is on your desk right now?
Another book that also is sort of an environmental book, like as this novel is, but the nonfiction book that I think everybody should pick up is The Great River, Boyce Umholtz's book that I think you interviewed him all back, but it is such a great history of the Mississippi River. It's sort of a biography of the river. It's similar to Jack Davis did that book that won the Pulitzer Prize about the Gulf. But this is kind of a 1,000-year coverage or more, I guess, depending on when you start. But it's covering the river into modern times and how it flows and what all the things we've tried to do to it that maybe we shouldn't have. And anyway, it's a great book that is highly recommended.
Well, I'm curious, Tom, does anybody ever come in, like a sales rep come in with a fall list and say, and here's a new book about the Mississippi River? I mean, and do you ever think, well, do we have enough? I mean, You know, there are so many, but there's endless appetite for them.
There's so many good ones, though, like John Barry's book on the Great Flood, The Rising Tide. That is, and, you know, of course, you can go back to Mark Twain, all of his books. So it seems to, just like you really never get tired of that. If you read his life on the Mississippi ties together so much in the country. It's just something that flows through, and it's the heart of so much storytelling.
The thing about Boyce's book is that it's like the history of the Mississippi for a new generation.
Yeah, and he takes in so much information.
Yeah.
He just has a capacity to absorb a lot of information and make sense of it, and it's highly recommended that I'm putting in as many readers' hands as I can.
Oh, yeah, I can see why. So what else is on your list?
I've just picked up a copy. This book is just out. It's The Bookshop, A History of the American Bookstore by Evan Friss.
Mm-hmm.
It goes early on, you know, Ben Franklin, of course, and Marshall Field, you know, and into modern times. And seems to be a fascinating story that I'm looking on to continuing on. But he interweaves a lot of information that is just a very good history of book selling and the bookstores and what role they played a lot. And there's so much information that any book lover will recognize and want to read about. So
I know it's like a great bookstores you wish you could have seen if you haven't seen them. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And so we're trying to tell the next chapter, I guess.
Of course.
Save you books. So, you know, we've been here for 24 years now. And at some point, as we're celebrating our 24th anniversary this fall, we're going to also celebrate our expansion that we've just completed.
And your part in the history of bookstores in New Orleans, which is long and wonderful.
Yeah, we're just a small, recent part of it. But it's such a great story that you have helped to tell also.
Oh, thanks. Well, thanks a lot. You happy reading this fall.
Well, same to you and to everybody. And if you don't know what to read, we've got great recommendations from our booksellers. They would love to talk to you about anything.
Absolutely. I can attest to that. All right. Thanks a lot, Tom.
I'll look forward to seeing you one day soon.
Okay. Take care. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Amanda Jones discusses and signs That Librarian, The Fight Against Book Banning in America, Friday, September 6th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop in New Orleans. Novelist Lady Hubbard, whose most recent book is The Last Suspicious Holdout, leads a workshop on the pleasures and perils of writing about family and community. That's in the Coffee and Craft series, sponsored by the Tennessee Williams and New Orleans Literary Festival, Saturday, September 7th from 10 to noon at Baldwin & Company. Free, but RSVP. The Poetry Buffet presents Scott Bailey, Carolyn Hembry, Michelle Nicholson, and Timeless, Saturday, September 7th at 2 at Vino on Oak Street. The Dickens Fellowship Reading Year begins Saturday, September 7th at 2. That's in the Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School. The first segment of the Pickwick Papers is chapters 1 through 11. New members are welcome. Ashley Cecilia Meyer discusses her novel The Cottage Witch of Venice with Corey Dupree, Saturday, September 7th at 4 at Baldwin & Company. Mike Strecker reads from and signs The Knights of Wade, Monday, September 9th at 6 at Octavia Books. Vanessa Kathleen, the Loyola English Department and Baldwin & Company, host a reading with Maurice Carlos Ruffin and Carolyn Hembry, Wednesday, September 11th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. Priyanka Matu discusses her memoir and letters, Bird's Milk and Mosquito Bones, with Jamie Attenberg, Thursday, September 12th at 6 at Octavia Books. Wallace, Wallow 267 Peoples, discusses and signs Armed with Good Intentions, Thursday, September 12th at 7 at Baldwin & Company. This is a ticketed event. Snowden Wright discusses his new book, The Queen City Detective Agency, with Adrian Van Young, Sunday, September 15th at 4:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Special guest poet Leona Sevick also appears. Best-selling author T.J. Klune discusses his new book, Somewhere Beyond the Sea, Monday, September 16th at 6 at Andre Caillou Center on Bayou Road. Only a few tickets left from Tubby & Coo's Bookshop. Trip Friedler discusses in Signs the Tunnel, a memoir, Tuesday, September 18th at 6 at Octavia Books. And coming up later this month, the Pirate Sally Faulkner Society announces plans for the annual fall festival Faulkner for All, September 27th through 29th. The festival opens Friday, September 27th at 11 at the Beauregard Kies House, and the overall theme is Diversity is an Inspiration for Literature and Life. Keynote speaker is Lawrence William Coates, a Faulkner fan and scholar and creative writing teacher, who will discuss the diversity of characters in the work of Mr. Faulkner. Best-selling author Thomas Mallon discusses diversity and information bombarding all of us today in a talk called If You Want the Truth, Read Fiction. After a break, sessions resume at 5 with a multi-author presentation on the deliciously delectable side of diversity, the cultural diversity which has given birth to the unique cuisine of New Orleans. Elizabeth Williams, founder of the National Food and Beverage Foundation and the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, discusses our Italian culinary heritage, and Sella Palmer speaks on the African diaspora and its influence on New Orleans cuisine. Finally, Williams interviews the 2024 special guest of honor, Marcel Bienvenu, whose classic, Who's Your Mama? Are You Catholic? And Can You Make a Roux? Will be reissued in a new edition this fall. For complete information, look at FaulknerSociety.org or email FaulkHouse@AOL.com. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.